Session number 11512, Reel 1.
Major Watson, Reel 1. Now, you were in France when the Germans attacked on the 10th of May 1940. Can you tell me about the background to that, what unit you were in and what rank you held?
I suppose I should start by saying that the war really began for me in mid-May when the German attack started. I had joined the army on the 18th of October, 39, into initially the Royal Engineers, as I couldn't then get into the Black Watch, my father's regiment. And I was sent overseas in December 39 with a unit called CRE, North Air Component, whose job was to construct and administer runways for the use of the British aircraft when they finally came to the forward areas in France.
Is that North in brackets?
Yes, our area was the Pas-de-Calais area, right down to, I think, down to or close to the Seine, where CRE South took over. We were stationed in a village called Hautecloque, near Saint-Paul, the big railway junction. And we ultimately got to our billets there sometime early in January 1940. It was a pretty atrocious winter, and perhaps I should recall a personal reminiscence that when I was issued with my kit, I was given two pairs of long johns, and being 19 at the time, I looked at these things with horror and thought, I shall never wear these, and they went to the bottom of my kit bag. But by Jove, when we got to France, I put a pair on, and I don't think I took them off until the end of March. It was so bitterly cold. The conditions were horrifying. And what impressed me most about the BEF then was the way in which our own units, Royal Engineer Construction units, worked in mud, slush and snow hard every day to build these and prepare the runways at places like Nunk, Tank, Douai, etc. And not only did they struggle hard during the day, but in their so-called spare time, many of them being units that were almost engineering companies in Britain. One I remember in particular, headed by Major Brandt from Aberdeen, who was the manager of this engineering construction company, had been more or less put straight into uniform and taken to France to do these jobs. And as I say, in their spare time, they were supposed to do a bit of basic military training, including rifle drill. And I think that was a tremendous achievement by these fellows. And the other people who impressed were the Darnars, the dispatch riders, who in the most horrific conditions of snow, ice, blizzard, etc., would go out at any hour of the day and night most cheerfully and communicate between the various headquarters or companies, whatever dispatches they had to deliver, and the RASC drivers, who had to really drive to dumps and areas which were well off the beaten track and off roads, almost over ploughed fields, in the most incredible conditions. And yet the cheerfulness with which they did it was, to a young lad like myself, one of the most lasting memories of that period of my life.
Why do you think they did it with such good spirit?
Well, being highly prejudiced, I think because they were British. I got a very high conceit of British people and the kind of amalgam of spirit, obtuseness, stubbornness, which seems to create an individual or a character who it often becomes more cheerful as conditions become more difficult. As I say, I'm highly prejudiced in that area. But it is quite astonishing, and when one heard of what happened in the First World War, it's perhaps even more incredible that they went through conditions that we certainly didn't meet to the same extent in the Second World War. These are the basic impressions that I formed during that period. I don't know how personal one should be in this account, but the unit I was with consisted largely of what one would term Cockneys, Bond, Hall, Pritchard, etc. Most of these were drivers or dispatch riders. Incredible spirit. We lived with relative happiness and often extreme discomfort in our billets in Otklok, and throughout this winter, and finally came April, when the weather became better. I disposed of my long johns, and we went into May, which became cloudless May in our view, because it was a most magnificent time of year. Blue skies, warm sun, completely different from what we had experienced in the previous few months. Then began the rumours that something was happening or boiling up somewhere, and our closest contact to the source of these rumours came when two allegedly German agents or Fifth Column or spies, whatever they were captured at an estaminet, which was a small French café, not far from our village. Then came the stories of Germans dressed as nuns who had somehow percolated into that area. How true these were or not, I don't know, but the whole area became full of a feeling of, I suppose, increased tension, because there was something in the air. And then, towards the middle of May, word came that we had to withdraw from the position in which we were. Here one perhaps should explain that I suppose we were, 40, 50 miles behind what was the front line. It may be less, it may be more. And we had had no, as it were, direct experience of fighting conditions, except in the middle of May the incidents I have given, and the fact that the odd aeroplane came over, and we had to put into use that magnificent air raid warning system, which was rather like a stirrup pump on three legs. And you held the top and wound the handle round, and you got this great kind of moaning sound that cover should be taken because an air raid was about to happen. I, at the time, had been put in charge of various stores, I suppose a kind of quartermaster's job, in this particular unit. And I shall never forget, I had them stored in a schoolroom on the stage. I shall never forget the other chaps in the unit. I was a mere lance corporal, eventually became a sergeant at the time, saying, well, look, if the Germans are coming, we can also have new battle dress, we can take this out of stores, and we don't have to sign for it, and so forth. There's a strange feeling in me, and always has been, I suppose it's with a fairly strict upbringing, that at no time do you ever loot, is a strong word, not to be used here, but do you ever take something that doesn't belong to you without, in the army, at least signing for it? And I steadfastly refused to let anybody take anything out of stores to which they weren't entitled. I suppose I needn't have bothered, because a few days after such incidents as these, we were moved lock, stock and barrel out of the area because the Germans were apparently advancing in the direction of St. Paul, having broken through between the Maginot Line and the Belgian frontier, and our own troops in the front line were withdrawing. By a most circuitous route, which entailed going in one direction at one time, in the north-westerly direction, then apparently proceeding due east, we finally came to Boulogne. I've since discovered that because our route was so haphazard, well, because the intentions of the German spearhead or the direction of the thrust was never apparently very clear to the people on the British side in charge of our troops. And I suppose one strong contributory factor was the fact that the hosts of refugees, which we began to see on the road very quickly after leaving Otclock, so made it so difficult to appreciate, was this sweep of refugees in front of a German column that was coming forward, or was it just the general feeling of panic and hysteria that had got hold of the local population, that they were fleeing away from, they knew not what, or they didn't know that it was in that specific area. But we literally didn't know where we were from 1 hour to the next over the next 3 or 4 days. We finally, after going through these long columns of refugees, and that was a horrific picture in many ways, because we were going in a northwesterly direction then. They were going in any direction to get away south, east or west from what was evident now was the German panzer troops coming forward. And we had to be quite ruthless in ordering them off the road so that we could get our trucks through.
And did you have to use violence against them?
No, on no occasion. But we had to be I fortunately spoke French and therefore was able to communicate what we required them to do so that our vehicles could get through. And we naturally felt we should like to do something to help these people, but in a way they were beyond help and we were certainly in no position to be of any assistance to them. The occasional German aircraft came over to machine gun the roads, which was again a pretty horrifying experience. Almost, and this was one's first intimate contact with war, it was almost unreal that we should be there and things from the sky were coming down and deliberately machine gunning, as it would appear, any group of people, be it fleeing refugees or soldiers, just like that. However, that's what we were in the army for. We ultimately got to a place called Etaples, south of Boulogne, and there we were taken out of our trucks and told to, in quote, guard, unquote, because being Royal Engineers, we didn't really appreciate what that might mean under these conditions, across roads. We were made to lie down on the ground. We were all told to load our rifles and put a bullet up the spout. But for God's sake, said the Sergeant Major, keep the safety catch on. So we lay down facing in, I suppose it was then a westerly direction, because by this time it was clear the Germans had hooked round and were driving towards the coast, somewhere south of Boulogne, perhaps around the Latuque area, and were reputed to be then advancing along this road on which we were lying. I suppose we lay there, not being, as it were, infantry and therefore real soldiers, wondering what we would do and what was going on. We were anxious without being afraid. We were very glad when, after some time, a company of infantry came in trucks and moved through us to a position presumably closer to the German line of advance. And we were then put back in our trucks and driven toward Boulogne. There was a chap called Lulu Wright who was in our truck, and all of a sudden there was a terrific crack as of a rifle being fired, at which we all jumped and thought, my God, it's come at last. And all that had happened was Lulu had inadvertently taken the safety catch off his rifle, had not taken the round out of the breech, and had fired a shot, but not in anger. Many sweet things were said by the NCO in charge, but ultimately we got closer to Boulogne. But the crush of refugees by this time was so intense that we had to stop to try and clear away. And I, being then in charge of stores and being able to speak some French, was sent forward with a 1,500-weight truck into Boulogne to get some food and petrol, which we were running short. And I suppose the officers in charge didn't know whether we would still need more stores or not. I managed to get through the crush of vehicles on the road by exercising my French in, I hope, an understanding but certainly very dominant manner, and ultimately got to the centre of Boulogne, which was a bit of a shambles, but not as crowded as the outskirts because most people had left Boulogne. I went to the NAFI headquarters to get some food and chocolate, etc., and produced a bundle of, I suppose I would sign for it, to the chap behind the counter. He said, don't worry about signing for anything, mate. Take whatever you like, because we are off. I forget how I overcame that one, but I got the stores there. Then I went out to the petrol dump, a most enormous petrol dump that seemed to go for miles. In the, did we call them jerry cans in these days? Anyhow, petrol cans that I think held 4 or 8 gallons. There was not a sentry in sight. A German aircraft was going overhead. And I remember standing at the edge of this petrol dump after taking the petrol that we'd acquired and thinking, do I set a light to this now? Or do I leave it? I ultimately decided, being, I suppose, too young to take a decision of that nature, not to set it alight. Although it did seem to me at the time that conditions obtaining were such that it was more likely to be used by the advancing Germans than by our own troops. Whether that was the correct decision or not, I've often wondered since. Well, ultimately got back onto the road, the Boulogne Tap Road, to meet our unit. The road was a bit clearer by this time, and we went as fast as we could, and suddenly the driver said to me, look, we've just passed some of our blocks. So we fortunately turned round and found that we had actually gone past our unit. Had we proceeded further forward, again, one wonders such things in time of war, especially when you're young at that age. What would have happened if we had gone further forward? We might have well ended up the rest of the war as prisoners of war, or perhaps even worse. But finally we then, as a unit, got to Boulogne, onto the quay, which was this time was covered with army vehicles, guns, troops of various nations, Dutch, French, ourselves, Belgian, and were told to wait on the quay side. I've often tried to see in subsequent years if I could recognize the particular spot, but buildings, etc., bombed, razed to the ground, rebuilt, it's become almost impossible. But then the heavy German bombers began to come over, and we were all told to lie down under our trucks. And I thought, damn this for a lark. I'm not going to let any Germans make me lie under a truck. So I stood outside the back of the truck and fired off my rifle, much to the, what's the word, amazement or horror of the other chaps in my unit. Fortunately, no bombs were dropped. They were clearly going further south to bomb French ports or bomb our own troops who were then fighting the Germans. We ultimately got onto a destroyer in Boulogne Harbour, being told to leave everything. And I can't recall whether we were told to leave our rifles or not, having taken the bolts out. I know I've read stories that troops came back with everything, except the they came back without anything except their rifles. I can't remember whether we brought our rifles back or not, but I hope we did. I can incidentally remember still the number of my first rifle, Z2662, an old SMLE. One wonders what's happened to it now, probably scrap. We came from Boulogne to Dover at a remarkable speed. I think she must have been doing 40 knots because the crossing was extremely quick. And there, somewhat dishevelled by this time, certainly hungry and rather dirty, we stepped ashore in Dover. It would have seemed that the local population was fairly used to this kind of thing happening now, but they seemed to still look at us with a mixture of amazement and horror or surprise, I don't know, that here were vestiges of the British Army coming back from France.
I don't suppose you know the date that you got back.
I think it was something like, oh dear, I forget when Boulogne fell, but something up between the 20th, 23rd of May, I think, something like that. Maybe in a few days later. It was all a bit confused, I must say. An incredible experience. I remember we went to High Wycombe from Dover. Did we go? I can't remember. We went to Salisbury Plain for one night. No, I think we went to High Wycombe. And we went to an RAF station. And there we had breakfast. And I was absolutely surprised, amazed and horrified to be presented with a plate of eggs and bacon, which we had never seen the like for months, and thinking, my God, how is it that the RAF can live like this when we hadn't seen anything of this nature for so long? We then were sent on leave to await recall while they sorted out our unit and the various other units with which we had by this time become mixed up. And people asked all kinds of questions when we got home to Perth, my hometown. And I shall never forget standing at the garden gate talking to my mother and father and one of our neighbours, and they were asking questions, well, what's happening over there? And I suppose, not knowing myself what was happening, trying to be reassuring or trying to give the impression that we weren't really being beaten, and saying, oh, the Germans will never take Paris. No, 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 the French will fight them tooth and nail, etc., etc. But of course, by this time, the Germans were certainly not far away from Paris. And their enormous dominance, military dominance at that time, and concentration of tanks and artillery had really overcome our and the French forces. I don't know if one at this stage should say that we went in June of this year, 1990, to Saint-Vallier-en-Caux, it being the 50th anniversary of the taking prisoner of the 51st Highland Division by, incidentally, Rommel, whom we were to meet later on in the desert, in a situation where they were completely encircled by the German tank and infantry forces, fast running out of ammunition, and where the French on their flank had decided to give in to the Germans, and General Fortune, without an adequate port through which to evacuate what was left of the 51st Highland Division, also ultimately decided that he would have to accede to the German demand to capitulate. It was a most moving pilgrimage, and although obviously I myself was not there, many of the people on this pilgrimage were there and were able to give us accounts of what had happened and of their experiences in the prisoner of war camps in Poland and elsewhere, to which they had been sent after being captured. And also to go round the ground in the close area of Saint-Valery with the people who had actually fought there and see the large dispositions which they had to defend and the concentration of troops that the Germans were able to bring at this very long, thin line of defence around and near the port of Saint-Valery-en-Caux.
Jumping ahead in your war experience to 1942, your next experience of coming face to face with the Germans, as it were, was in North Africa. How did you come to be there?
First of all, I'd like to explain that I'd always wanted to get into the Black Watch. My father had been a regular soldier in the Black Watch, had served through the 1418 war, and I had an uncle killed in the same battalion as my father was in before Arras in 1918. So I had initially been rejected because the recruiting sergeant said, he said, first of all, you're too young, laddie, come back tomorrow, which took a bit of working out, but I realised I should increase my age when I went back the next day. And the second thing he said was that if I went into the Black Watch, I'd have to be, I think it was 5 with the colours and 3 in the reserve. And in these halcyon days in late 39, nobody thought the war was going to last more than a year, so that was a commitment they didn't wish to enter into. But I thought I would get into the Royal Engineers, in which I had an uncle in the First World War, and then I would ultimately transfer. The transfer took a long time because of the German advance, and all the Bumford HQ was lost, including my transfer papers. So it wasn't until early 41 that my request to enter the Black Watch was again looked at, and I was sent to a pre-octu training place in Northampton, where we did some basic infantry training, and I then went to octu, which of course stands for Officer Cadet Training Unit,